Accession number 19904, reel 3.
But he turned out to be a very decent guy, and he took me by the hand. Rang just a moment. He rang the doorbell and asked for Mrs. Brown, and said, "You know, you have a kid that is talking a little bit too much. You better tell him not to do that." I don't know exactly what he said, but there, you can imagine there was a moment of panic in the house, electrifying panic, and I remember. They were going to do something with me, hide me, I don't know, somewhere. But then this element of fear really came home. You know, during the wartime, I would say I was living a bit like a prince. You know, I had there were anomalies to my life, in my life, but on the whole, life was good and kind. You know, I liked the people, I liked the environment, I liked everything. You know, except I knew I had to be careful. But that one moment, strangely enough, ironically enough, we're talking about maybe a day, 2 days, 3 days before liberation, where sort of reality,
Adrian Shepherd, Reel 2.
One of the anecdotes that I like to tell is at the end of the war, when the Germans had taken over the garden and set up camp there for 1 or 2 days, there was a German officer who rang the bell, I don't know, in the beginning or at the end of the stay. Apparently he was a very polite, very attractive man. And he asked if he could listen to the radio, and the radio was in the dining room. It had its special place. It was like the altar of the dining room in a way, and Mrs. de Brouwer apparently said yes, definitely, and he very politely turned the radio to the BBC. I should add a parenthesis right here, that although we listen to the BBC during the wartime, the needle was always on Radio Berlin, and we were told that we never listened to the BBC if anybody would ever question us. So it was, you know, the first thing he did after listening to news, he turned the needle back, and he came into the dining room, he turned to the BBC, and he heard the news, whatever was told in English. And apparently he stood erect, and he heard really what had happened, probably for the first time in many years, and this German officer apparently started crying, put on his hat, clicked his heel, thanked Mrs. de Brouwer, and left the house. And apparently Mrs. de Brouwer was very moved by this sort of, by his gentlemanly behavior, and because she had seen sort of what she thought a very honorable man being totally defeated in more ways than one. And that was an incident, apparently, that had left a mark on her. And of course, as we know, not all German soldiers were bad people. Some people, I suppose, were just doing their job, you know, and he might have been one of these people. But so that was an incident which apparently had left a certain mark on Mrs. de Brouwer.
Can you recall watching films in the evening, which you mentioned earlier?
Yes. Well, yes. Films were a kind of watching films and making movies was a very special event during the wartime. Of course, I don't know if I even had seen a film before the war, you know. And so cameras filming, and we're talking 1942 or so, so obviously not a very common thing, especially for a six-year-old child. But we took, there were always photographs being taken. I say always, there were photographs being taken, all the important events and films. And Mr. De Brouwer had a camera, and he had films. I don't know where he got them, and he even managed to get them processed. And every time there was a birthday or a special event or visitors would come, he would play these films in the living room, always after dinner. Of course, it had to be dark. And we children love it. We absolutely love seeing ourselves sort of doing whatever silly things we did, you know, jumping in the water, swimming, kicking our animals, sitting together, smiling, or doing something. And we never had enough of these films, and he knew it, you know. We didn't watch them every night, but we watched, I remember that watching them very, very often. And because cinema was still relatively new, especially home movies were was certainly not very common, relatives, where they would come and stay for a few days, would always ask if they would see the films again. And again, it was fun, you know, and you can imagine the preparation, setting up the screen, setting up the camera, putting the films and the whole thing. And we're, I can remember all of us sitting on the floor waiting for the great moment, and probably yelling bravo at the same time every time and reacting the same way. But yes, films, although it was a limited, was very limited in terms of time, was an important moment. We loved them. And Mr. Brouwer also was very much a pater familias in the truest sense of the word, and he wanted to record the clan. He wanted to record the life in his house. Unfortunately, he doesn't appear very often because he was a cameraman. I always regret it that I see Mrs. De Brouwer, see the children, and even today I love watching them, of course, with a very different eye than when I was a child, but I find that he's missing. But that's true for, you know, same with people who take lots of photographs and never photograph themselves.
Did he ever used to hire or show the cartoon films which were available?
No, I don't remember ever seeing cartoon films. It's possible, but I really don't. Or at least the life in a family eclipsed any other movie so much that from what I remember, the camera and the movie camera was reserved uniquely to recording live at home. Or events. Well, events, where I say events, it could be children playing or somebody learning how to dive for the first time in the water. That was terribly important to him, and of course, and he was very proud to see us climb on a trapeze or jump in the water. I think it was exclusively limited to that, to life at Saint-Denis and around Saint-Denis. I believe that at the end of the war, at the end of the war, he did film some of the parades at the time of the liberation, which was, of course, a moment of great ecstasy, as you can imagine. But that he did film. And I'm not sure he did not film a couple of places that had been demolished by V1s or V2 bombs at the end of the war. That's possible he might have recorded that. But the liberation, I've seen the films of the liberation of Ghent, and I think he recorded that quite extensively. I also think in retrospect, having seen his films, that he was quite a good amateur cameraman. I think the films are very clear, they're not, the scenes are not too long or too short, they're just perfectly well balanced.
Can we move on now to the post-war period in your own career, your move to North America?
Yes. Well, the post-war career, I suppose, begins with a phone call where again my father's my parents' close friend Germaine phoned us up to say that my father had come back, and that evening I remember that day Mr. Bra was phoned at the bank to, he was given the news, and that very evening we drove down to Ghent from Saint-Denis to this lady, and I met my father for the first time. I had, I can say forgotten him, but you know, for a child of six, a 4 year absence, of course, it's a very long absence. And, you know, all the whole war, you must bear in mind, you know, I'm told, quand tes parents reviendront, and so on, you know. So, and finally, the moment had arrived, you know, so one expected to, the moment to be sort of great. And what I remember is rather something which had affected me a great deal. I saw my father, a skinny little man, who of course cried, as you can well imagine, seeing his child again. He was anything but the hero a child would like, thinks his father ought to be. And again, I have to compare, the comparison was inevitable with my adoptive father, who was a pillar of strength and tall and strong and so on, and this sort of this man who was very much reduced by what he had gone through. And so the idea of going back was anything but a happy one in a way. I found it very difficult to accept the idea that I would have to leave to the Bras. I had taken it more or less for granted that this was my home, you know, not really thinking of the consequences. I learned later that the family in Israel and the family in Canada had hoped to bring me here, you know, by the way, thinking that I had been hidden by a very poor family that didn't have the means to support me. But so the episode really begins then with when my father came back. And then of course he had nothing. He didn't have a house, he didn't have any money, he didn't have a job. I stayed with the Brouwers for a while, and Mr. Brouwer, together with my father and Mr. Dope, agreed that possibly the best thing to do would be not to recreate a household immediately, which my father couldn't do, but to send us to a boarding school where, for two reasons. First of all, they thought it'd be an easier transition from our life with the Brouwers and the Dopes, and my to my father's house, and also it would be a chance for Claude and I to get reacquainted. We really didn't know each other. We were like two little strangers to one another. And we were sent to une colonie de vacances, one would call a camp here in Belleuil. The chateau, the Prince de Ligne had an enormous chateau in one of the beautiful chateaus of Belgium, in Belleuil. And he had converted a great part of the chateau into a sort of colony for children of prisoners and orphan children, people like ourselves and so on. So, and the Prince de Ligne was also a friend of the Brouwers, so there was a contact there. And my father agreed, and we were sent there for, so once again we were uprooted and sent to for a whole summer. It was just a summer, 3 months or so. And I remember hating the place, by the way, that's entre parenthèses. But and then we, at the end of the summer, we came back to Ghent. And my father by that time had found a little flat, basically three rooms. He had been able to buy some furniture, had gotten a job back with his former employer, and we set up a house as best we could, three men, one man and two boys. And quickly my father felt that Europe was finished for him. You know, he had suffered too much. My father, my mother had died. All his friends had disappeared. literally he was the only survivor of the camps in Ghent, I learned last week, of the camps. So he felt that he wanted to go to America. He had two brothers in North America and one sister here who he hadn't seen for a long time, but c'était le Nouveau Monde, l'Amérique, and so on. And he tried to emigrate to the United States. It didn't work out. It took a long time. It was arranged that he would emigrate to Canada. And by 1949, I think we got our papers, and we emigrated here in March. March of 1950 to Canada. In the beginning, again, there was a difficult period of readjustment. You can well imagine, no home, no money, no. And my father lived with his brother here in Montreal, and my brother and I were sent to his sister, who lived in a small town in Ontario. And also, because she had no children and she wanted to have us. And I went to school in Morrisburg, Ontario, a small town of about 1,100 people, where it had a dry goods shop. My father, while living in Montreal, met someone who became my stepmother, who's still alive today, actually a wonderful person, and he remarried. And the moment he decided to get married, once again the family was reunited. In fact, it was the last time that we lived again as a family, father, stepmother, and two brothers, and eventually a sister about a year and a half after they were married. My father had a child, Judy, my sister, who now lives in Toronto. So the family was reconstituted here in Montreal, and it was on the whole a very happy period. It was a particularly happy period for my father. He was happy in Canada. He loved being again with the family. He was amazed by the informality of life, the lack of bureaucracy, especially even compared to Europe and compared to even Canada today. Things were simple. He liked his job. He liked his friends. He was very much in love. He had a new child. It was very much a new beginning. He was a man of about 44, I think, at the time. I went to high school here. I graduated from fairly good high school and went to McGill and entered the School for Architecture, and basically followed his footsteps, as my daughter is doing now. Life on the whole here has been for us a fairly good one. There was, of course, one difficult period. My father, unfortunately, died very young. He died at the age of 48 with a child that was less than a year old, I think, or maybe slightly over a year, and a wife that was 37, I think, at the time. And once again, you know, it was starting all over again. So we lived with our stepmother, my brother and I, and my sister. It was, you know, the usual difficulties, the shortage of money and so on. But eventually all, you know, with family help and summer jobs and so on, we resolved things pretty well, pretty quickly. And when I finished university, it was a six-year program I was in architecture, and at the end of my 6 year I graduated and I left her. I mean, I went on my own, got a little apartment and so on. And, you know, after that I really can't complain. Life has been, the universe started to unfold as it should, as they say. I got married to someone I met at university, we traveled a great deal together. We continued doing graduate studies in the States and so on. And my brother, by the way, we finished at the same time, university at the same time, although he started before me, but he took a second degree, studied law, went immediately into practice quite successfully, I must add. And he too got married, had raised a large family, has five children, and has been living in Montreal. And both of us, I would say, are very happy living here. We often think back of life in Belgium and our childhood, and although I'm somewhat more sentimental than him, at least he doesn't want to show his sentimentality, I think he shares my feelings, but he sort of I think that looking at it quite objectively, when we talk about Belgium and our childhood, we sort of thank our lucky star that we made our life alive here in Canada rather than in Belgium. I'm attracted to Belgium. I return virtually every year, and of course I have this whole family, this whole for me it's kind of the source and the real connection with my childhood. There's something about the smallness of Belgium. Parts of it are very beautiful. The food is very good. People can be very kind. I love many aspects of Belgian life, but somehow this scale and an informality and a kind of democratic aspect to Canadian life, which I like a great deal. I see it in my professional life. My both as an architect practicing here in Montreal with five partners, rather an average size office, 15 people, five partners, and so on. There was and same at McGill with my colleagues, every nationality, every background, every cultural situation you can imagine, and it works very well. I like that. I feel very much at ease in this environment. Sure, Montreal is not as beautiful perhaps as some European cities, the visual aspects of life are, although they're terribly important to me, they're only a very small part. So really, I'm very happy living here, and to talk more specifically about my life in Canada and whether one should live here or not, we had a bit of a fright at one time, maybe an unjustified fright about Quebec separating, and people thought it might become somewhat of an extreme right-wing or racist kind of state. I think we were wrong, perhaps, but there was a fear, and we, Sylvia and I, often talked about, if you had to leave Quebec, if we had to go and live somewhere else, where would you go and live? Well, of course, the rest of Canada, but, we don't like the other Canadian cities. Would we go to the States? Would we go to Europe? And at least it was a time, a moment to reflect on the fact that I really like Canada. But in fact, to be more honest, I really like Montreal. It's a city that suits me in sort of every way. I like its size. I like its cultural life. I like its mixture, its biculturalism, or today, I want to say, its multiculturalism. It's a city that suits me very well. So I'm happy here.
Thank you very much, Nathan.